going once, going twice. Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. Before we start, we are going to roll over Senate Bill 954 to Wednesday's meeting, so that will not be worked today. And we're going to start off by opening a public hearing on House Bill 3188.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, House Bill 3188 comes to you from the other side, from your parallel revenue committee. The House Bill 3188 in the A engrossed version, which means the amendment that was made in the House revenue had to deal with fixing some of the language and some of the impacts that could have been on a fiscal note. House Bill 3188 has to deal with the economic development funds that go from the state lottery to counties. As I put in your packet, a couple of exhibits on how the those revenue amounts. This is the 2%. From the video lottery that goes to county economic development, and it is divided based on 90% where these amounts, in which county they originated, and 10% in equal distribution. You would see that different amounts go to different counties. I put on the 0709 biennium in your packet, as well as some of the monies in this biennium. What this would do is mandate the counties to start reporting on the activities of economic development that is connected to these funds. Basically, put more concentration on the dedication of those funds to the economic development function. And basically asks an addition, asks the counties for reports to go to the Department of Administrative Services. And the Department of Administrative Services, I think they would be putting them on the transparency website.
Okay, and we have two sponsors of this bill in the audience. Welcome Representative Wand and Representative Sheehan. Committee.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Members of the committee, I'm Matthew Wand, State Representative from House District 49. I want to thank you for scheduling this hearing and work session, and also a thank you to Senator Montes Anderson, my senator, who is a co-sponsor on the bill as well. This issue first came to me a handful of years ago when my commissioner for Multnomah County, Diane McKeel, who's a good friend, mentioned that she was trying to figure out how the county was spending the economic development lottery revenue share dollars, and she was unable to find the answer. And it seemed to me that at the time I was a city councilor in Troutdale and had just gone through several budget committee cycles, and during the course of that, all of the funds that the cities raise that are dedicated to particular uses are separated out into separate budgetary funds. And that's the way we organize it, to make sure that those monies are spent in the proper way under the statute. And it seemed to me that if my county commissioner couldn't figure out how this money was being spent, that was a problem. And so the solution that is before you today in HB 3188 is really very simple. We ask the counties to segregate out the revenue stream and the expenditures into a separate budgetary fund. It's very easy for them to do. Secondly, we ask that they report on the Transparency in Government website that's maintained by the Department of Administrative Services with regard to exactly how the money is being spent. And then thirdly, we've tried to provide a little bit more, I think guidance might be the right word, for what economic development really means. And I know that I'm scratching the surface here delicately on a topic that can sometimes be a little interesting, but right now, under current law, it says that these monies should be spent on economic development, but it doesn't really attempt to define what that means. And so, hence, when you have a term that's not really very well defined, it can mean almost anything that you're willing to argue it really means. And so it seemed to me that that was not as desirable as it could be. And so Legislative Council did a great job of finding a definition that's already in the statute for furthering economic development, and it includes things like trade groups and grants and loans. But it also includes construction projects, everything from transportation to community centers and everything in between. So it may not be the silver bullet for what economic development ought to mean, but it gets us, I think, a lot closer. And in the meantime, we get a good government bill as well. So I'd urge your support.
Thank you, Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Patrick Sheehan, State Representative, House District 51. I'm just here to answer any questions and back up Representative Wand.
Okay, thank you very much. Questions from the committee. Senator Telfer.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Now, I have no problem with the transparency. My question on the dedicated fund is, you know, as a CPA, we have fund accounting. We have accounting rules on how to do this. So what is it we're trying to fix that accounting rules don't do? And obviously, we can't bump up against them. Are we talking about a separate bank account? I mean, we have fund accounting, mm-hmm. and they're supposed to be reported in a separate fund, which has its own assets, liabilities, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So what's the purpose of the bill having to set up a dedicated fund?
Chair Burdick and Senator Telfer, not all of the counties segregate this revenue into a separate fund. In some counties, these revenues are rolled into the general fund. And as such, since they are rolled into the general fund, they are not traceable. We cannot determine how these funds are spent because they're in the general fund.
All up,
please. Thank you. Are they not legally restricted, the use of those funds to begin with, so that they still get earmarked even if they're in the general fund?
Chair Burdick, Senator Telfer, I don't know. From an accounting standpoint, I don't know the answer to your question, and I apologize for that. I know what my experience is, which is that they are, in a couple of counties, they are simply not traced. They are not accounted for in a way where you can look at a website and see, County X got $2 million of shared lottery dollars for economic development, and they went over into these projects and programs over here.
Maybe I could ask Mazin the question then. Are they not legally restricted, these lottery funds, to their use so that they would be segregated in the accounting function? You know, whether they're not on the website is something different. So,
Senator, I put in the SMS, you would have the ORS citation for that restriction. And the restriction says that they shall dedicate those 2.5% of the video lottery to economic development, but it does not, in essence, give more guidance, if you will. So in a way it is restricted, but in another way it doesn't say more than that.
Deborah, can you shed any light on this,
no.
enforcement? Okay.
No.
Well, wait. We've got the counties signed up.
Well, it might be either the DAS or the comptroller or somebody because, you know, under GASB 54, this should be being taken care of. And we need to, we are implementing that as we speak to be fully up and running on September 11th, 2011, or September 16th, 2011. So I guess what I'm just
Would
wondering.
Would you please translate that?
Well, we have a new accounting law that directs how these things are accounted for. And it's to be implemented in Oregon's tax year, it's going to be September 2011, whereby all the funds now have to be itemized as to whether they're constitutionally restricted, statutorily restricted, which I assume this is what this is. Federal monies that are federally restricted, and then those that are merely designated within the agencies that have no legal restriction. And so what I'm saying is this is already being taken care of, and a lot of countings, particularly those using fund accounting, are already doing this. So in any case, that's why I was asking, because as I read the definitions, it almost looked like we were talking about setting up a whole new bank account. So I'm not necessarily opposed to it. I'm just wondering the need. Transparency, I don't have a problem with the reporting back, et cetera, but as far as directing a county how to set up their accounting system, obviously we cannot override accounting rules.
If I may address that, Chair Burdick and Senator Telfer, again, not being an accountant, I'm doing the best I can, but what I was trying to do here is legislate from my experience and the experience of my county commissioner, which was a question, how is this money being spent? The answer, it's in the general fund. It's spent on everything in the general fund. It's not accounted for separately. And so, again, drawing on my layman's perspective on a budget committee, I knew that we had fund accounting in the city of Troutdale. And so it just seemed to me that one way that we could get at that was to ensure that the counties are engaging in that process for these monies. Because, again, this is not only statutory, it's a constitutional mandate. These funds, these lottery funds, are to be spent on economic development and nothing else. And so that's, it just seemed to me as a layman, again, not as an accountant, that that was a good way to go. And it certainly was not my intention that a bank account would be set up separate from anything else. I'm trying to get at exactly the fund accounting that you're talking about.
Well, if I might offer, it sounds to me like your county's doing something illegal, whether it be unintentional or not. But if it's, in fact, dedicated, legally restricted, dedicated is not a legal term, but if it's legally restricted, it can't be just thrown into the general fund. So I assume your county's audited. Does their annual audit?
Chair Burdick, Senator Telfer, you know, I'm not really that deeply involved with the county. I wouldn't be able to speak to the legality or non-legality of any of those things. I just identified a problem, and I'm doing my best to try and fix it.
Go ahead, Martin.
Chair Burdick, the constitutional dedication of all revenue coming from lottery is for economic development. And then within the legal definitions for the money that goes to the 2.5% that goes to the counties, that I think that dedication is by assumed as a transition, because this is in general constitutionally dedicated, so therefore this money that goes to the counties would be dedicated. That is now the legal dedication is not ironclad, if you will. So there is a transfer to the counties, and some of that transfers, by the way, was taken in the some of the fund sweeps of the last biennium. As you see in section 36 also, I put in your SMS, the state was able to defer some of that transfers to away from the county transfer. So the GASB 34 might...
54.
Oh, it's 54 now. It used to be 34.
34 is the other one.
Yeah.
Okay. It occurs to me that we may be able to, if on line 13 it says, shall deposit the monies into a dedicated fund, and then on line 19 it says that monies received as described in this subsection may not be placed in the general fund. It occurs to me that maybe we could broaden that language out a little bit, that the counties shall assure that the money is accounted for and have a system where they can account and enforce its use for economic development. And then when you on line 19, if you had a provision not necessarily placed in the general fund, but may not be used for other purposes other than economic development. That's really what you're trying to get at here, rather than where the money's located.
Okay. Well, then we're talking about a bigger issue here. If, in fact, we swept those funds, that means they are not constitutionally restricted, and they can be used in the general fund.
Right.
Wait a second. We swept them from the lottery, correct? We didn't sweep them from the counties. We swept them from the lottery, correct?
Well, we swept them from some of them from the lottery, and some of the amount that was going to the counties. Now, that is not a constitutionally dedicated amount. There is no constitutional dedication to go to the county in that sense. It's all within the statutes. And since it's within the statutes, you can actually statutorily do that, make that change. And we have done that. And that's, I think, sometimes there's a disconnect, because what is dedicated constitutionally are certain things, and the general use of lottery funds is dedicated constitutionally for economic development. So the 2% that goes to the counties are assumed to be also under that constitutional dedication, but they're not within the statute explicitly dedicated to economic development.
So it's not like we're trying to correct something. We're actually creating something new here. A new statutory restriction on the use of funds, because right now they're not statutorily restricted, it sounds to me, so that when these lottery funds go to a county, the county could use them in the general fund for anything. Thus the need for some sort of statute that puts the sidebars on the legal, whether it be statutory or constitutional, but some legal restriction on the use of these funds. So what I'm hearing is, currently there is no legal restriction, whether it be constitutional or statutory. There is no legal restriction on the use of these funds by a county. So we are, in essence, not just fixing a bookkeeping problem. We're actually setting policy on how counties can use these dollars. That's what I'm hearing.
But the constitutional overriding type of use for the lottery funds are economic development.
And well, that's economic development, education, and right. Salmon and parks, one of those three. Do you want to respond to that, Representative?
Yes,
well,
thank you, Chair Burdick. It's not cited in the bill, but the statute that sets forth the division of the 2.5% shared lottery dollars that goes to the counties does state that they are to be shared and used for purposes of economic development. So that statute, and I'm sorry I don't have that on my fingertips, but it sets forth the formula that Mazen talked about with 10% to all and then a division based on population over above that. It does say economic development in that statute. So it's not completely unrestricted. It's just not as clearly defined as what this bill defines it.
Senator Morris.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. It's ORS 461.547. And it does have a requirement or restriction for economic development activities. It seems to me that the problem here is the definition. And Mazen, can you direct us to the ORS that would give definition to economic development activities?
Well, that's ORS 461.540.
540?
That's listed
okay.
In the bill. Yeah.
Let's go back and look at that.
And the bill grabs that definition, which is used, I assume, for the state economic development activities.
That's the state fund.
Yeah, so are we, I mean, I assume what we're trying to do here is be consistent that the counties can only use the money for economic development activities that are the same as the state's. Somebody from the counties just moved from the last row to the first row. Come on up, Ann.
Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Ann Hannison with the Association of Oregon Counties. Constitutionally, when the voters approved that amendment, they dedicated originally for economic development. And so that is grounded in the Constitution. The statute does do some interpretation of economic development, and then the Attorney General has also defined it in advice that the Attorney General has given. Economic development, though, has been defined, you know, very broadly. So the state has used that broad definition as it's used its lottery dollars for economic development, and so have the counties also used it in a broad way. And that's been good, because counties are different in terms of what they need for economic development. So it's been used for infrastructure. It's been used for workforce development, for revolving loan funds, depending on what the needs of that county is, and also on the state level, depending on what the needs of the states are.
And does the definition that's lifted for the purpose of this bill, 461.540, does that accommodate what's going on in the ground in the counties for economic development?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, yes, that's the same definition that the state has for economic development. So that's what this bill refers to, is that same definition, which then is consistent with the constitutional definition. But again, it's a, you know, it's a pretty broad definition of what economic development encompasses.
Okay. And did you have?
I was just going to say that you're correct. It is very broad.
Mm-hmm.
If I might read, this is for the Administrative Services Economic Development Fund, which is the state, and may be used for any of the following public purposes: one, creating jobs; two, furthering economic development in Oregon; or three, financing public education. Now, those are very, very, very broad.
Exactly.
But it still begs the question of, really, what is economic development? And then further down, it talks about the Oregon Constitution provision. Creating jobs includes but is not limited to supporting the creation of new jobs, helping prevent the loss of existing jobs, assisting with work transition to new jobs in Oregon, or training and retraining workers. But as you read this, I'm not sure how that specific definition applies to the general state economic development fund. But apparently the counties have been using this in a very broad way.
Yeah. Chair Burdick, Senator Morse, that's correct. Counties have been using it in a very broad way. They've, for example, Lincoln County has used it for revolving loan funds. They've used it to attract NOAA. Other counties have used it for tourism purposes, for economic development, like Marion County used it to help pay for the Oregon Gardens. Others have used it for constructing needed infrastructure to industrial sites. And the same goes with the state. The state has used it for workforce purposes. They've used it, like, with the Special Public Works Fund for recapitalization of that, which provides water and sewer-type infrastructure. You know, given the needs of what it takes to develop jobs, there's a variety of different things that may be required in order to do that. So it on the one sense, it's very broad, and on the other, it provides you with a lot of flexibility.
Yeah.
Well, just going to ask, are there counties that are using it for, like, public safety, fire, life safety purposes?
I don't know, Chair Burdick, Senator Morse, I don't know some of the specifics. We did have a project a couple years ago where we asked counties how much have they spent on economic development, not exactly what they've spent it all on, but how much they've spent. And so counties have often spent much more than what they've received in the video lottery dollars for economic development purposes. But yeah, I can envision, Senator Morse, a situation where, say, you have a new industry coming in, and unless you beefed up your fire department with, say, some special equipment, you wouldn't be able to attract that industry to the area. So that's why you need some flexibility in terms of how to use it.
The transparency provisions in here, are the counties, do you think that's something that all the counties will be able to accomplish?
Chair Burdick, I think so, because as they budget for these dollars, and most counties already do have a dedicated fund for video lottery dollars, so they can see pretty readily how they're spending those dollars. So I don't think that would be difficult for counties to do. And in the case of Multnomah County, they spend quite a bit on economic development. They will then have to focus these dollars on those economic development purposes.
Okay, so it's really, if they disclosed where how they were using the money, it really wouldn't matter that much where they were parked. It's how they're used. Is that your concern?
Well, it just gets back on track. This bill does not do anything about defining what economic development is and what dollars can be used for. What it merely does is talk about accounting for it, mm-hmm. so that it's transparent. And like you said, Madam Chair, I think the transparency comes from how you report the dollars. If $1 million goes into a general fund that is is statutorily restricted for economic development because it's lottery funds, it's tagged with that all the way through the bank account as it's expended. So the key here is really the subsequent reporting of how those dollars got spent. They're still earmarked all the way through as they go into the bank account and as they come out, whether it's the general fund or some other fund. So I'm not a municipal auditor, and it would be interesting to talk to the OSCPA Municipal Audit Division to say, I don't know if this bumps up against anything, which we couldn't do and get a clean audit for somebody. So
how about this committee? If you go to line 13 and lose that line where you talk about depositing the money into a dedicated fund and retain all the other provisions, including the definition and the transparency, would this avoid some of the possible pitfalls of the accounting, the new accounting rules that are coming in and anything that might exist?
Well, it might. It isn't just because of the new accounting rules, but it would be interesting to throw this by the municipal auditors of the state who have to oversee the rules on how counties use them to see if this bumps up against anything unintentionally, and unintentional consequence that makes it counties can't do this and still get a clean audit.
Now, are you talking about the transparency or
the how they report, whether it goes into the general fund or not?
Yeah.
I mean, it's how they report it, I think, is where you're what you're trying to get at, and I'm fully supportive of the transparency on the subsequent report that says here's how we use that $1 million.
Well, how about if we required the counties to develop a system for accounting for the money or to have
reporting, maybe
have a system for following it through, like you said, earmarks or whatever. But I think all your concerns are pretty much summed up in that line 13, where you're requiring a, because you're not having problems.
Yeah, I guess.
Chair, if I may, Chair.
Yes, please.
Chair Berg.
B.
There's also a kind of a realism aspect to the way that these budgets are created that I wouldn't want us to forget about, which is that you have a group of folks that are on a budget committee or on a county commission, and they sit in a room and they go through fund by fund, and they make decisions fund by fund about what the proper dollar amounts are to be allocated, and one of the reasons why I liked this approach as a general proposition is that at one point in time during this meeting, one of their staffers says, okay, now it's time to talk about the lottery economic development revenues. How are we going to allocate those in the next budget cycle? And however we describe that in a way that matches up with what the auditors tell us doesn't throw a monkey wrench into their process is fine, but that concept of sitting around a table saying, what do we do with our lottery economic development money this year, I think is largely beneficial.
Senator Telfer, would you be willing to work to locate an auditor and work with them and give us some language that would...
Happy to, because one of the other things would be, how do they track and spend and account for transit room taxes? It's the same thing. They are legally restricted to be used for something. Again, it's a little broad in its definition. But they have to count for it's the same thing. And they can all go through the general fund as long as they can account for it and separately. They don't have to display it separately. I guess that's the difference. You're talking about something that displays accounting information on a financial statement.
That's right. Yes.
And I'm saying I don't know that it I don't know that we can actually force somebody not to put it in the general fund and put it into something that just displays the information. I think a subsequent report would probably serve just as well. But I'm happy to do that and give me a week or two.
And I'll
to work with the representatives because I think they're onto something really good here. It's just that I just don't want to bump up against something that's going to cause all these counties to not have a clean audit.
Chair Burdick, Senator Telfer, I'd be happy to work with them on that. I do want to add that counties do have to go through, adhere to local budgeting law, and they do have to be able to go through and present a budget by fund, outlining how they're going to spend each of those funds, and they have to do that consistent with law and with the Constitution. And in so doing that process, they would then identify, like some counties, you know, that do already do have a dedicated fund, how they're going to spend those dollars, which is, I think, what Representative Wan and Representative Sheehan are asking to do. And that is, that is good to be able to see just what counties are going to spend that on.
Okay. So you just got yourself assigned to the work group as well.
Fine.
So if you all can, but I think that's really where our issue lies is you know, where you put the money and how you count for it. Mm-hmm. So thank you for bringing this to us. Is there any other comments or questions?
I would just point out inconsistencies in the write-ups. One write-up directs counties to report to the Lottery Commission. The other write-up, fiscal write-up, report to DAS. So it's one or the other, I assume, not both.
I think when Representative Wan started with this bill, it was to do with DAS, with the state lottery, and then it became a report. So
it's amended.
It's a engrossed bill at this time.
Okay.
Maybe the title is, still carries the old title from before the amendment.
But good sharp eyes, Senator Morris. Other questions or comments? Thank you, and
thank
we'll
you
look forward
much.
To seeing this back. Anybody else want to talk on this one? Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3188, and we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 20, and nobody has to talk slowly. This bonus.
Yes.
And we just had live entertainment.
Senator Burdick, Chair Burdick, and the Senate Bill 20 last time when we were talking slowly to wait for the fiscal, and I think today in your packet there is the fiscal. And the fiscal says for the Dash 4 that there is no expenditure impact.
Which we already knew, but we couldn't move forward anyway.
Well, we just to be, as they say, for sure.
Okay.
And that basically clarifies the last thing that you were looking at the other day.
So we have a Dash 4 amendment that was explained in excruciating depth by Mr. Salvaggio last Friday. So I think we're ready to roll on this one. Senator Morris, do you have a motion?
Did we adopt Dash 4?
Did we adopt them?
Let me...
Did we adopt them, Paul?
We
did. So, Senator Morris,
okay.
We're actually ready for a motion.
Wow. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 20 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 20 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Is anybody wishing to carry this? Okay, I'll carry it. All right. Now we will open, what will we open now? Now we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2612. Mazin.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, the Senate Bill 2612 also comes to you after it passed through the House Revenue Committee, and as we looked at this more carefully, we were trying to find out what will be the impacts of these different definitions. I think everybody looked at this and answered the questions to us at different times. These all are definitional issues that are being fixed and changed. You have also in your packet two letters, one from the state treasurer and one from the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and they're both talking to the same point, that this is primarily not necessarily a big impact for any change of way of doing business. However, the state treasurer, although neutral on this, as they say in their letter, they do indicate that there is a slight increased risk of concentration of funds. So, and those concentration of funds, basically about the non-secured funds that are secured through a pool of or a joint pool. So, so this is what you have for House Bill 2612, and in the SMS also I put the basic law definitions that you have for that background.
Nobody signed up, but I see Mr. Martinez back there.
Oh, we have a sign-up sheet.
Oh, thank you. Okay, Linda Navarro. Your first appearance before our committee this year. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Navarro. I'm president and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association. And the bill you have before you, House Bill 2612, is really a technical change that relates to a change made in the abbreviated 2010 session. During the 2010 session, there was legislation that moved through the process to provide credit unions with the ability to accept public funds. And in that bill were some other technical changes to the public deposit statutes. One of those changes attempted to clarify an inconsistency that was in the statute about which protections provided for in the statute applied to insured funds or including uninsured funds. So the attempt to fix it was to take the word uninsured out of the different places that it appeared. And actually the intention of the law back when it was put in place in 2007 was to have these protections apply to uninsured funds. So we're seeking to put the word uninsured back in the statute where we believe it belongs. Just to back up for a second and explain, Oregon public funds, that is the cities, counties, water districts, those funds, when they're deposited into banks, those that fall within FDIC insurance limits are considered insured. Those that are above that are uninsured, and those are the ones that are protected by Oregon's Public Deposit Protection Program. And in 2007, the legislation created a whole new program for public deposit protection that created a what's called a pool or a shared liability model. So the protections that are in the statute are actually to protect the banks from participating in a shared liability model with each other. So you don't want, if you're a bank participating in a pool where you have shared liability for a loss to that pool, you don't want one bank to have too much concentration compared to their net worth or to be undercapitalized. And so when certain factors occur, the pledging requirements, the collateral that the participating bank has to pledge, goes up. And we're saying that those, the funds that are at risk and the banks that are at risk are those that are participating in a pool to protect uninsured funds. It really doesn't impact FDIC insured funds because they're not covered by the pool. So I know that sounds confusing. I've been working on public deposit protection programs for about 15 years now, so I'm trying to explain it in a logical manner, but if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
the treasurer points out that this bill reverses a distinction that was made in 2010,
mm-hmm.
And so now we're undoing that. Why was what was done in 2010, and why are we undoing it?
So, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, in 2007, when the pooled program was put in place, there were certain places in the new law that referenced uninsured funds, meaning that these thresholds, these measurements I just talked about, applied only to uninsured funds. But there was a couple other places where it didn't speak specifically to uninsured funds. So there was a recognition that there was inconsistency in the statute. Do these protections apply to all funds or just uninsured funds? In the fast pace of the 2010 session, and I know you all remember the pace of that session, an attempt was made to correct that. That was actually to remove the word uninsured from the statute. That had the effect of saying that these net worth requirements applied now to all funds that a bank might have, all public funds that a bank might have, even those that are insured by the FDIC, which have nothing to do with the Public Deposit Protection Program. Those are excluded from Public Deposit Protection because they're protected by FDIC insurance. But all of a sudden, you have to calculate your limits on how much public funds you can have based on all public funds, even if you've done a good job trying to model your public deposit program at your bank to take advantage of FDIC insurance. So this simply goes back to the way it was before 2010 and says that these protections for the other banks that are in the pool are there for the pool itself, which is uninsured funds.
Okay, so you're saying that this is correcting an inadvertent error.
Well, I don't know if it was Chair Burdick, I don't know if it was inadvertent in terms of when it was inserted in the negotiations by the Treasury. I think that we went back to some email traffic, and there was some, we had weighed in at that point in some email traffic, our counsel saying, no, the purpose in the work groups that established this program was for these thresholds to apply to uninsured funds. But for whatever reason, that didn't get fixed in the language of that bill. And as you may recall, we were focused on the bigger policy issues in that legislation and not all the technical issues. So in our mind, it shouldn't have been changed. And the Treasury, I think, agrees that it's absolutely fine. They wanted consistency, and as you see in their letter, they're fine
with
that.
They did point out that it could increase the risk profile of it because of the transient nature of public deposits.
Well, Chair Burdick, I can't speak for the Treasurer, Darren Bond, but I can say that the only place that could really occur is if you said that a bank was going to have a massive amount of public deposits that were insured by the FDIC, and that somehow created some sort of concentration. But anything that is not protected by insurance is part of this legislation and in part of the Public Deposit Protection Program. So I can't really make a connection of a great deal of additional risk other than, you know, you could say that a bank has a lot of public funds as a percentage of their net worth, but those public funds are insured.
And the difference between the insured and uninsured is just the amount below the threshold and above the threshold, the maximum for FDIC insurance.
Yeah, Chair Burdick, it's a little more nuanced than that, only because the FDIC insurance threshold is $250,000, but there are some tools in a bank's toolbox to take advantage of insurance above $250,000. It's still FDIC insured, but one example would be the Certificate of Deposit Account Registry Service, which is permitted for public funds, and it's a program where you can, on a reciprocal basis, work with other banks around the country to maximize the FDIC insurance a depositor can have. That's available to individuals and also to public entities. So in that case, the insured amount that a single depositor could have at a bank could be many, several million dollars.
All right. Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reference to the February 2010 legislation, was that the one that was contentious between credit unions and commercial banks? I'm trying to put this in context.
Chair Burdick, Senator Morris, yes, I believe so. Now, I haven't gone back to the actual bill, but I think that was the only bill related to public deposits that went through the February session. So I believe that's the bill.
Okay, thank you.
But this wasn't the primary issue being dealt with that bill. Okay, other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wanted to testify on this? Okay, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2612. And all right. So committee, do we have some head nods to open a work session on this? We're posted for a work session. Okay, I will open a work session on House Bill 2612. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2612 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved House Bill 2612 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Hess, would you like to carry this?
That's great.
Okay, now, committee, my first instincts were correct for the record. So without objection, I would like to suspend the rules on consideration to reconsider Senate Bill 20 for purposes of actually adopting the Dash 4 amendments. Without objection, so ordered. We'll now open a work session on Senate Bill 20. Senator Morris, do you have a motion on the Dash 4 amendments?
Yes, but I need to have the date.
Dash 4 amendments.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 20 dated 4-7-11.
Senator Morris has moved the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 20. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 20 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 20 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
It was like deja vu.
Deja vu all over again, Senator Telfer. Okay. Without objection, Senate Bill 20 as amended is adopted, and I will carry it again. Okay. Now, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2071. Chris, welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2071 grants rulemaking authority to the Department of Revenue to require paid tax preparers and corporations to file electronic returns if they are required to do so for the federal returns. The bill would allow the department to establish exceptions to these rules and applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2011. And in your packet, you have the complement of paperwork. You have fiscal impact that indicates a minimal expenditure impact. And the revenue impact has a minimal impact of a loss or gain of less than $50,000. And that's basically from DOR's experience. The electronic returns tend to be more correct than paper returns, but they can go in offsetting directions.
Okay. Ken Ross signed up on this. Welcome.
Thank you.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Ken Ross from the Department of Revenue. Just real quick on this bill, as Chris said, this would allow Department of Revenue rule writing authority to tie us to the federal mandates for filing returns electronically. It also allows us to write rules to provide exceptions in case of hardship, whatever that might be. Thresholds, as they stand right now, it begins in for tax year 2011, so returns filed next year in 2012. At the federal level, it's any paid preparer that anticipates filing 100 or more returns, and that's in the 1040 series, the 1040, 1040A. So it's all the personal income tax returns. For tax year 2012, that threshold drops to 11 or more. So if they file more than 10, they have to file them electronically. For corporations, it's the mandate's already in place at the federal level. It started in 2008, and that is corporations that file 250 or more returns in a year. And they define returns. It includes not just tax returns, but also the W-2, the 1099s, those sort of things. Just a couple things on why DORs bring this forward. As Chris said, there are some advantages. The error rate that we see in electronically filed returns is significantly less. For the season we're just that just ended, that we're still processing, the returns that suspend from the automated system that we have to look at because they have some kind of error, for paper returns, about 20% of them. For electronically filed, it's about 6%. It also, obviously, there's a reduced cost to file or to process returns electronically, and it also costs a lot less to store them. And we also have the ability to capture and use information more efficiently. And just one final thought on that. We did go out to some stakeholders. We have a listserv that the practitioner world belongs to. We did an informal survey that way. I think out of all the responses, we had one person that objected to it. But overwhelmingly, there were no issues with a mandate. Most of them are saying we're already doing this for the federal level. If we're filing returns electronically for federal, we're filing for Oregon, so it's not a huge burden. So with that, I'll answer questions.
I wonder why somebody would have, maybe it was a Luddite.
It's probably my office.
I was thinking it might be my accountant.
It's probably in my office.
Okay. Questions?
I do have one question that's unrelated. Back in, I think it was 2005, we had serious breaches of our IT systems in the state. And I'm wondering, and I've never heard back, Paul, maybe you know, I've never heard back the follow-up to see how we had corrected that problem. And I think it also included the Department of Revenue. It was something that never got a whole lot of attention, you know, publicly, but it was of concern internally.
Senator Morris, to my knowledge, we haven't had that issue with our electronic filing system. I'm not aware that even on our like our accounting system or we've had any kind of breach that we've had an issue with. We did have and it probably was back in that time period where we had somebody was an employee, a former employee, was out on a website that they shouldn't have been, and it did a little tracking or whatever. And so we thought maybe we had a few accounts that are compromised, and we did some preventive maintenance there. But there's never been any major issue that I'm aware of.
Thank you, Senator Morris. Deborah has moved up one row. I don't know quite what.
She's going to move back because he did exactly that.
Okay. You have to get the body language of the audience straight here.
For another day.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. Okay. We're going to close the public. Oh, anybody else want to talk on this? Now's your last chance to be a Luddite. close the public hearing on House Bill 2071. And I think we can open a work session on this. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2071. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2071 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved House Bill 2071 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. there's only one person on this committee who could possibly carry this bill. So Senator Telfer will carry this bill. Okay, is there any other business for the committee? We have tax expenditure tomorrow at 8:30, correct, Paul? And from now on, we'll be meeting pretty regularly on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And our next revenue committee, for Finance and Revenue Committee, is on Wednesday. So for now, we are adjourned. For now, we are adjourned.